This is Spectrum.
Alternative Myth, Homeopathy, Secret Society, Hypnosis, The Paranormal, Alternative Energy, UFO Abduction, The Weird, The Wild, and The Wonderful.
With your hosts, Tom Theophanis and Scott Jordan.
Hello, good evening, and welcome to the Spectrum Radio Network on BBS Radio 2. This is Scott Jordan here with my co-host, Tom Theophanis, and remember, there's no such thing as too much information. Well, I'd like to thank, today we're doing a special show, I'd like to thank Doug, Don, and Seth at BBS Radio for helping set this up. I would also like to thank the people working in the background. We have the Project Avalon moderators here with us, and I'd like to thank them for all their help. Tom, how are you doing today?
I'm good, Scott. Well, today we're doing this special event. Our guest today is Bill Ryan from Project Avalon, who's the co-founder of Project Camelot, and he has a Bachelor of Science in Mathematics with Physics and Psychology. In May 2006, he co-founded Project Camelot with Kerry Cassidy. Camelot was a bold and highly successful adventure into cutting-edge investigative alternative media research, generating over 100 full-length video interviews on a number of alternative and controversial subjects, addressing some of the most important issues of our time. Bill is currently based in Europe, but travels widely, and Project Avalon is his new site, which he runs independently. How are you doing, Bill?
Well, fine, thank you. I'm here in Europe, as you say. It's the middle of the night. I'm just waking up, and I'm delighted to be with you guys.
Great.
It's a little bit of an experiment today, isn't it? Because we're fielding questions from the good members of Project Avalon, and this is also going to be. Is this being broadcast live at the same time? It is to an audience of thousands.
We are live. People. Yes, millions.
Million. You never know. This is one of the exciting things about radio: is you never know who's out there, and you never know who's going to be out there when they pick it up later. This is the interesting thing.
This is absolutely true. I mean, you've been advertised on BBS Radio's front page for about a week now, so I'm sure lots of the regular listeners to BBS Radio are aware of your being here, with you being world famous and all.
So, Bill, tell us how you got involved in the Project Camelot.
Okay, it's a story that's often been told. I'll try and compress it down to about 60 seconds. I was visiting Tintagel in Cornwall in England in April 2006 with Kerry Cassidy, and I previously met Kerry because a few months prior to that, I got myself involved as a webmaster for an interesting release of information coming from Victor Martinez, who runs a UFO-related news group based in Los Angeles about the so-called Project SOPO. We might even touch on that this afternoon if anybody wants to know about that. But I'd hooked up with Kerry basically because of that, because I got myself involved in a release of classified information just by sticking my hand up in the virtual audience saying, oh, I can do that. I can design a website. This is interesting stuff. And before I knew what was going on, I was propelled into a world of considerable intrigue. And without planning to in any way whatsoever, I became a very minor celebrity, and I became very controversial just in the space of a few months. Kerry was actually very skeptical of myself and the SOPO story until she interviewed me. And she interviewed me at the Laughlin UFO conference at the beginning of March 2006, and she talked to me for about 10 or 15 minutes about the so-called SOPO project, and then she turned her little camera off. And then we continued talking for about 2.5 hours, and we realized very quickly that there was a tremendous bond of shared perspective, shared questions, shared interest, and shared commitment to get to the bottom of whatever it was out there that there was to get to the bottom of, which is a lot of stuff. And we very quickly became very shoulder-to-shoulder close friends in this. And a month later, we ended up in Tintagel, England, when she was visiting England on her way back from a trip to Egypt. And very spontaneously, we were visiting Tintagel. We were very inspired by the place. It's the so-called Avalon of Arthurian legend. And we were on our way back to London, where Kerry needed to catch her plane the next morning. And I suddenly thought of the idea of this project that would be a major whistleblowing project, that in our agreed view would basically be hanging on the coattails of Stephen Greer's Disclosure Project, because we'd both been an admirer of the ideals of that project when that kicked off in May 2001, I think it was. And at that time, 2006, we hadn't really heard much from the Disclosure Project since then. And we thought, well, you know, I don't know what's happened to this, but maybe this is the kind of game that everyone can play. Even if we've just got a little pocket-sized camcorder and no money and nothing at all, we can actually start doing this. And it's kind of like we dared to believe that we could do something. It was like a grassroots Disclosure Project. And we both simultaneously got very excited about this whole idea. And we had the whole thing mapped out, visualized, and agreed. It must literally have been within a couple of minutes, literally. Within about 120 seconds, thought, yes, we could do this, yes, and this, and this. And let's have a tribute page to people who have given their lives to this. And yes, let's. And we just had the whole thing. And within 2 minutes, we had the entire thing just sort of established in our minds as a concept. We had no idea where the whole thing would lead. We realized later that in some ways we were sort of, dare I say it, we were kind of born for the job, or as one or two other people have joked, straight out of central casting, you know, because you had the American and you had the Brit and you had the difference in styles, and it was like Mulder and Scully from X-Files, and it was, you know, it was like the guy and the girl and the Bonnie and Clyde and the whole thing. And we never planned or strategized anything whatsoever, but what we very quickly learned, because people were writing to us to tell us, is that we were inspiring a whole bunch of people, because we were seen as being a sort of grassroots movement. You know, we didn't have any money behind us. No one had put us up to this. We weren't representing any institutions mm-hmm. or organizations. We were just Mr. and Mrs. Everyman. I mean, we're kind of quite an interesting Mr. and Mrs. Everyman. But having said that, we were no different from many of the people who are listening to this program right now. We're no different mm-hmm. from you, no different from all the Avalon members, no different from many people listening to this show. And that isn't to say that we're all ordinary. It's actually the opposite. It's to say that we're all special. But the challenge here is for us all to act on our specialness, because times are so critical at the moment. And this is maybe something that we can talk about in the show for the next 2 hours. We can't sit back and be spectators. By repeating each other's messages on Facebook, this doesn't change the world. You've actually got to do more than that. Right. And so there's something about getting this message right out there. There's something which is to do with waking up more people than just everyone else in this little sort of feel-good family that we've got. There's a very, very large job to do. And this is what Kerry and I always exhort people to do when we're talking to people in conferences or in the opportunity of radio broadcasts like this, is just to get out there and start doing something rather than talking to people who already know about stuff. But I'm going to stop now, because otherwise I'll talk continuously for 2 hours, which yeah. I'm very capable of doing. I apologize for that.
That's okay.
What's the next question?
You know what is amazing to me is that you and Kerry were on separate missions. Then you met, and everything changed. I mean, it was almost like a fated meeting. And look what's become of Project Camelot. It's so huge. Honestly. I do have a question, though.
Go ahead.
Celine wants to know, what book have you read that most impacted your life?
Oh, boy. I'll try not to stare out of the window too long on this, because long, thoughtful silences don't make very good radio. the most useful answer I can give immediately would be The Holographic Universe by Michael Talbot, which I would strongly recommend anybody out there who's never read this or never heard of it to grab a copy. It's available in paperback. Amazon's got copies just for a few dollars. It'll change your worldview. There are many other books will do that as well, but that's my flash answer, and that did have a significant impact on me when I first read it, which was quite a long time ago. I think it's back at the end of the 1980s. That's my best answer to that question right now.
That's a good answer. I'd go with two books. I'd go with Magic and Mystery in Tibet, and I'd go with Psychic Discoveries Behind the Iron Curtain. That would be me.
And I've got both of those on my bookshelf. Yeah.
Really? That Psychic Discoveries Behind the Iron Curtain is not easy to get a hold of.
I bought that fresh off the shelf more than 25 years ago when it first came out. And this is an interesting story because, of course, the Russians at that point were ahead of the Americans in their psychic research. And this caused quite a scramble among the Americans to actually catch up with the Russians. And this is one of the reasons why the remote viewing program went underground, literally, using drugs, hypnosis, and electronics to enhance the products that they were getting. Because there was a whole psi race going on. It wasn't just a weapons race, it was a psychic weapons race, if you like. Not only connected with remote viewing, but to do with remote influencing. And when you start getting on that kind of subject, then you start treading on quite thin ice because the powers that be don't like people to know that that kind of thing is a reality. And of course, there's this semi-comedy film that came out recently, you know, The Men Who Stare at Goats. But there's a lot of truth behind that. There's a lot of truth behind that. And it was arguably a little bit of a disinformation job to actually present it as wacky comedy in the way that they did, because there's very, very serious research that went on behind the scenes there.
Yeah, so a lot of research on the top level or the public level on SRI, which was the top level sugarcoating projects that were going on that you could access and communicate with them.
Yeah.
But there is stuff going on a deep level that nobody ever heard of, or very few people heard of, and you wouldn't be hearing about it in the public. That's for darn sure.
That's for
okay. There's a second question from Fred here. Tom, if you want to.
Yep. He's asking, have you heard from Credo Mutua lately? Any news of his trial and health?
Good question. Actually, I have not, I'm afraid. And the reason for that is simply that I never had a direct line to Credo. My line to Credo, as it were, came through David Icke, who's a very close friend of his, the two Icke brothers. And David himself, I don't think, has been in touch with Credo recently because he's been in the middle of a very grueling international speaking tour. And one of the things I want to do between now and the end of December is catch up with David and ask him how Credo is. So I'm afraid I don't have an answer to that question.
Okay. That there was a secondary question to that is, was any word on the stolen artifact? Did you hear anything about that?
Ooh. I have heard nothing. Yes, I need to think very carefully about how I should say this. I've heard nothing that I could substantiate about the artifact. The only thing which I sense, and other people sense as well, and which was hinted to me by somebody who had reason to have some information about this, is that it will not be returned. Now, that's not what people would have wanted to hear me say, and it's not what I actually wanted to say. And I don't even know if that's true. But just looking at the evidence, so to speak, the fact that this thing was taken from him,
right
back, I think it was in March or April of this year when this actually happened, and it hasn't been returned now, and therefore the odds on it turning up or being returned to him are probably getting pretty slim, you know. So I'm afraid I don't have anything positive to report about that.
Okay, I have a question from Heretic. Let's see here. In my view, there seems to be a growing disparity in the conspiracy world concerning current events and the implication of these events. Some are reporting that plans of the powers that be are getting stronger and taking hold towards our doom with vaccines, geoengineering, economic catastrophe. Others, like Fulford and Wilcox, see the powers that be endgame thwarted and getting under control, or at least on a path. I don't know if there's a question there. Let me think. I guess he wants to know what you think. Is it all doom and gloom, or is it what Fulford and Wilcox are saying about it's the end game for the powers that be?
Okay. It's not doom and gloom. That's right. For sure. Let me say that emphatically, clearly, and straight away. And my reason for saying this, and I've said this over and over again, and I'll say it again until people get tired of me saying it. If it was all doom and gloom, I wouldn't be here. Neither would you, neither would most of the people listening here. We wouldn't have come to this planet. There are many other places you can turn up for an incarnation to have a lot of fun and challenge and learning and stuff. Why come to a place that's going to self-destruct where it all ends up in tragedy? I didn't come here to play a fixed game, and I don't believe it's a fixed game. And there are so many people who have come here, what Dolores Cannon calls volunteers. The first wave of those volunteers are probably in their 50s now, and then there are other waves that followed. There's a whole group who are in their 40s, there's a whole group who are in their 30s, and then there are all the kids coming through, all kind of building on top of each other. Sometimes I get emails from people saying, well, when's the cavalry going to arrive? And my reply is like, well, go look in the mirror, you know, because we are the cavalry. We shouldn't be waiting for someone to come and save us. We've got this in our hands in theory. And this relates back to what I was saying right at the start of the show, which is that it's not about talking to each other. It's actually about expansive, practical action out there. And maybe we can talk about this just a little bit more later as this show progresses. So that's my message of encouragement to people. This is not about doom and gloom. It's not about choosing which way we're all going to die. You know, I mean, it just isn't like that at all. There's a real tipping point here. And those of you who know my work and have listened to my various presentations over the last 2 or 3 years know that I often relate this to a game. And in relating it to a game, I don't mean anything trivial about this. If you're playing in the Olympics or in the Soccer World Cup or in any other major, or in the Super Bowl, to you guys over there in America, it doesn't feel trivial at all when you're in the middle of all that. It feels like high drama, and it feels like you're playing, you know, that you're the best and you're playing against the best, and everyone's watching and there's a lot at stake, and that's what it feels like. It doesn't feel trivial. And this is the kind of thing I mean when I talk about a game here. And I think the game is balanced. I think the game really is balanced. And one of the reasons why there is such a lot of activity in the skies and has been ever since 1947 or 1941 or whatever it was that the visitors really started to roll up in numbers is because this really is where the action is at. This is a theater where a lot of stuff is being played out, and there's a lot at stake, I have reason to believe, and there's a lot hanging on how we handle things here down in planet Earth. And I don't think there's any overt interference in the game from the ETs, but I think there may be, I mean, here I'm talking about the benevolent ETs, but I think that there's a lot of subtle encouragement and intervention that doesn't violate any of the rules and protocols, which I think is really very important. We've got a lot of people out there, and I say people advisedly, because they are people. They're people like us. They may look a little bit different every now and then, but they're all people. We're all people. And they're rooting for us in many ways. But because this is all about free will, it's all a learning process, an experiment, whatever words you want to use, the outcome is not certain. And the importance of the outcome not being certain, just like it is at the start of the Super Bowl or the start of the Soccer World Cup, that gives us encouragement because it means that we're in with a chance, otherwise we wouldn't be there on that playing field in the first place. And so that's all a kind of slightly complex response to people saying, is it all doom and gloom? The answer is absolutely categorically not. I think this is a very, very exciting time to be here. And what I've heard, and I'm willing to say this on record here, what I've heard from insider contacts who I've been in touch with is that a lot is going to be resolved one way or the other in the next 6 years. It's something like that. I don't know whether it's five or I don't know whether it's seven, but it's like the next handful of years will decide which way this whole seesaw is going to tip, one way or the other. There are all kinds of games being played out here. And as regards the encouraging news, it's very clear to me that some things are not going according to plan and some things are not going according to schedule. And many of you may remember way back, it feels like a long time ago now, but it's just over a couple of years ago in 2008. Kerry and I, at that point, we were really becoming quite concerned because we had picked up something like 14 or 15 different independent strong data points that there was going to be something huge and bad that was likely to occur around the back end of 2008. Possibly a nuclear war, something to do. I mean, there's just a whole bunch of stuff about bad things that were going to happen around about then. That was the time when Dr. Bill Deagle had his very famous nightmarish vision that really terrified him. And he's not a man to be terrified easily, but he was really, really shaking and almost in tears when he phoned us to tell us about this nightmarish vision that he'd had of an American city that was engulfed in a nuclear explosion. I mean, he didn't invent that stuff, and he's not crazy. He really saw that. And to the people who say to me, well, you know, this proves that Dr. Bill is deluded, or this proves that Dr. Bill is crazy, or this proves that Dr. Bill is wrong all the time, or something like that, I say, no, 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 you've got to see it in a different way. He saw something that clearly didn't transpire. We know that it didn't transpire in our timeline, but this may have already happened on a different timeline. And it's actually quite strange putting those words together in the same sentence, you know, and I'll say it again. That may have already happened on a different timeline. In other words, it didn't happen to us. It happened to another version of us that we're not experiencing consciously right now. And this all gets very weird when you start talking about things like this. But the upshot of my long answer to this part of the question is that I do think that there's been a timeline change. I do think that we're heading in the right direction, whereas back in 2008, it was by no means clear which direction we were heading in. But I think that we're not out of the woods yet. It's not all over. You know, it's not time just to go back home and just relax because things can flip backwards and forwards in all kinds of different ways. And like many people listening to this, maybe like you guys, I look at the mainstream media every day. The first thing I do when I wake up, besides checking the alternative news media, is I check the mainstream news media. I look on BBC and CNN to see what's happening in the world, to see what they are telling us is happening in the world. And then every day, besides a few little skirmishes here and there, like the thing in North Korea and, you know, various scares and various rumors, it's like, okay, you know, we're still standing. Nothing bad has happened yet. And there's all the kerfuffle that happened just almost exactly a month ago with Cliff High making dramatic prognostications seen in his webbot project, Half Past Human, pretty much forecasting, you know, that the what's-his-name was just about to hit the fan any day now. He gave a date and a time. He was wrong. Now, like Bill Deagle, he may not have been crazy about that, but what it shows is that that technology that he was using is now no longer adequate for forecasting the future because it can be wrong, and thank goodness it can be wrong. It means that the future that we're creating is actually transcending the ability for people to be able to forecast it. And just like Bill Deagle was wrong with his vision about the nuclear attack on an American city, thank goodness he was wrong. That was avoided as well. And so we don't know where we're going here. No one can forecast this stuff anymore. We can't forecast it. We can't forecast it in our dreams. We can't forecast it in our channeling. We can't forecast it with the half-past human technology that they've got using the analysis of asymmetric language. And I bet you that the insiders can't forecast it for them either. It's wide open. And that's my answer to that question.
That's good. So, Bill, I have a question of my own. What do you think of the field right now? How do you see it compared to, let's say, 20 years ago?
The field?
Yeah, the field of all these areas that we're playing with.
UFO investigation, paranormal investigation, yeah. Disclosure.
I think that 20 years ago, let me think, where does 20... When does 20 years ago take?
Let's say in the 90s compared to now.
Okay, sure. I remember, right. It's a good question. Because shortly before that, in something like 1988, and maybe some of your listeners will remember or be able to research the dates a little bit more accurately than I can, but round about 1987, 1988, this is when Bill Cooper, William Cooper, and John Lear started to talk about an aspect of the ET and UFO phenomenon that was much darker than had ever been published before. And that's also when Val Valerian, that's the pen name of Captain John Grace, started to write the Matrix books. And I remember back in 1988, 1989, I got hold of a book called Matrix 2. And it was basically what he did was he just published his entire filing cabinet full of drawings and research articles and contactee reports and hypotheses and photographs. It was an incredible book. It was like a sort of paper database of stuff, but it contained material that previously hadn't really hit the alternative media, stuff to do with genetic experiments at the Darcy base, things to do with cattle mutilations, things that suggested that part of the agenda might be darker than had previously been thought by most people. And with some exceptions, before that time, and I'm speaking really, really generally here, because we're talking about kind of trends of alternative culture, if you like, in the way that all of that has evolved in the last generation or two. In the 1950s, the culture was like the George Van Tassel and the George Adamski culture, which is like, oh, look, you know, there are these humans coming to us from Venus. How interesting, you know. And I'm being a little bit flip about this, but I'm just trying to paint something in a caricature. And then in the 60s and 70s, it was like, well, you know, maybe they're not from Venus. Maybe they're intergalactic. And I wonder what kinds of power systems that they really used to get here. And that's when Leonard Stringfield started to research into crash retrievals. And the whole subject started to acquire a sophistication about how these visitors from other planets were getting here and what were they really doing here and what was the whole kind of taxonomy of all the different types that were coming here. And that's when the gray started to become anchored in people's minds as a recurring feature in all of these reports. And then after that, there's this other wave, which is when everything started to get darker, like, oh my goodness, you know, this is, I think it was Bill Cooper, who really started to publicize the idea that there was a deal made between the Americans and the ETs back in Edwards Air Force Base, then called Muroc in 1954, and so on and so forth. And all the things that we now, that have become part of the lore and legend, an established sort of ground floor set of agreed assumptions about the field. Just over 20 years ago, all of that stuff was kind of new. And since then, I guess there's been another another sort of aspect of this as well, which is people saying, well, you know, maybe these aren't extraterrestrials at all. Maybe they're hyperdimensionals. Maybe they're us from the future. Maybe they're time travelers. Who knows what they are? And that kind of mixed up with the darker possibilities of these. And of course, debating whether the ETs are benevolent or dark or whether they're some of each has been one of the touchstones in the alternative media for a very great deal of conflict, including the very famous interview between ourselves and Stephen Greer that happened in, when was it? That was July last year, which may be something that people want to ask us about. But it's like, are the ETs benevolent? Are they demonic? Are there a little bit of each? Who's controlling the insiders here? What's really going on? Why aren't they telling us this stuff? If there are visitors in rocket ships, then maybe this is good news, but they're not telling us this. Well, why aren't they telling us this? What is there to hide? And there's all this whole discussion about disclosure, which many of your listeners will be familiar with, that it's all very easy to conceive of a world leader, whether it's the Pope or the Queen or the American president, going out on the balcony and saying, okay, you know, this is the truth. We've been visited by beings from another world, and isn't this wonderful? And they're our brothers and sisters under God, and we should welcome them, and they've got a lot of nice things to give us, and everything's cool. But if you imagine that being a press conference, then an hour or two into that press conference, you start getting some very, very, very difficult questions being asked. And that's the reason why disclosure has always been a problem for the controllers, and probably it has been hotly debated on the inside for over 60 years now. That it's not the simple questions that are hard to answer. It's the tough questions about the darker side of this, and some of the deals that or the compromises that may have been made, And the introduction of that darker side, this loops right back to the start of your question, was, I think, started to happen just over 20 years ago.
Okay.
Okay, I have a question from Undead Pixel. Bill, you said this interview would be a preview for the upcoming conference with Carrie, David, and Richard about disclosure. Can you elaborate, please?
Yeah, right. Okay. On Sunday, this Sunday, the 14th, not the 14th, that's today, whenever Sunday is, it's the 19th, at around about the same time, and the details are on the Project Camelot site, will be on the Avalon site as well. There's going to be a teleconference with myself, Kerry, David Wilcock, and Richard Hoagland, and we're all going to be talking about exactly what I'm talking about now. It's going to be four times as good because they're four interesting views there, all of whom are happy to talk nonstop forever. And so the discussion that we could well have between us about exactly what we've been talking about so far in the first half hour, that's what that show is going to be about. It is a paid teleconference. It's going to cost $39. And if you want to be part of it in terms of asking questions and listening live, then there's like an entry fee to that that virtual conference room. I believe it'll all be it'll be recorded and it'll be released much later, and I don't know when, and I'm not in charge of all of that. That's what I meant by preview.
Okay.
I'm looking forward to it as much as anyone else is, because I don't actually know how, for instance, David Wilcock would have answered the question that was put to me about 15 minutes ago about, is this doom and gloom or is it all over now? You know,
right.
It would be very, very interesting to get those views.
Wow, four people that can answer a question in a half an hour all together in one room. That's going to be amazing.
It would be impossible.
Yep. Can you imagine? Okay, Tom, there's another question from Harley.
Harley has a question. It says, could you please explain to the audience what a false flag attack is? Why would it be used, and possibly give an example?
What a great question. Okay. Right. False flag. The origin of the false flag is the the old idea of a ship that claims to be sailing under one flag, in other words, you know, one nationality, one agenda, one navy, when actually it's in disguise and it's really got something else going on. And then by the time you realize that you've been tricked, it's too late, because by this time a war has started or something like this. 9/11 is a classic example. Bert Tonkin in the Vietnam War is another example, something that Jesse Ventura talks about, because he was kind of involved in all of that. So a false flag event is a trick where we're tricked into believing that we've been attacked, whereas actually we've set it all up ourselves. The Reichstags, the Reichstag fire in what year was that? 1933, was it? I can't remember. Which the Nazis. That was their version of 9/11. Now, the context of this, and I know where Harley is coming from here, is the idea of a false flag alien invasion or threat or setup. Something that, like 9/11, did really very successfully, despite everything that went wrong and despite all the blatant giveaways to the fact that this was a manufactured event, it did actually do the job, because politically and through the mainstream media all over the world, a new reality was established, which is that we had an enemy when we woke up on the 12th of September 2001, which we didn't know that we had. It's like, oh my God, we've got bad guys over there. Okay, we better go to war. How do we know we've got bad guys? Well, look at what they just did. And so all of this was sold to us, and we bought that story. Now, the purpose of that, without this talking about 9/11 for the next hour and a half, was to create a new enemy, which actually, anyone who's read George Orwell's 1984 knows how convenient it is to create enemies in order to control populations and to make you do, to make them do what you want them to do for your own agenda. The enemy is just a means to an end. It's just to create a something to get people focused in a particular direction, to get them thinking about things in a particular way. And then, of course, because enemies are dangerous, then you've got to sacrifice a bit of freedom in order to protect the public against this new enemy. And so right now, this is probably best typified in terms of the very severe searches that are done by the new breed of scanners at airports, not only in America, but increasingly in other parts of the world as well. So we lose something, and as David Icke likes to say, this is problem-reaction-solution. It's the problem-reaction-solution equation, which is you create a problem, you stimulate a reaction, the public react by saying, help us, save us from these terrible terrorists, please, this is what the government's for, and then the government says, well, okay, we'll save you, but you know what, you've got to go through this, that, and the other procedure, you need identity cards, we've got to police you, we need to set up camps in case anyone is out of line and we think there might be terrorists, and then it's a slippery end of a very long, thin wedge that ends us with us sacrificing our freedoms, which was the intention in the first place. Okay. So what Harley is talking about here is a false flag alien threat.
Okay.
This was predicted by Carl Rosin and by Wernher von Braun, who Carol Rosin says warned her about this in the last years of his life. And Wernher von Braun was very deeply on the inside. And although he started off his life, his young life, being a Nazi, arguably he was a good man with a foot on the inside and a foot on the outside. That's what I tend to think based on what I know about him. And I think he was warning us. The idea of this thing called Project Bluebeam has been bandied around on the internet for the last, well, ever since the internet was established, really, for about the last 13 or 14 years or something. Serge Monast, if I've got his name right, was a researcher. He was slightly wacky. He's no longer with us. Otherwise, it would be very interesting to ask him where he got all his information from. He had one foot in the esoteric, And he called this project Project Bluebeam. Now, I've been told that this is not what it's called on the inside, but I've been also told that there is a plan sometime either next year or the year after that, provisionally at the moment. And I say provisional because all of these rollouts of events are not date-driven. They're not calendar-driven. They're sequence-driven, meaning that before they do something, they have to do something else. And before they do that, they've got to get these pieces in place and so on and so forth. One of the reasons why none of these things have happened yet is because the rollout of certain things is slow and the whole sequence has been slowed down. And this correlates with, rather dovetails with the question that I was asked about 20, 25 minutes ago about whether it's doom and gloom or whether it's all over. I mean, once again, I'm being a little bit flip. But things are definitely slowing down and they're not according to plan, and we haven't had an American city that's been blown up by a nuke yet. Now, so 2011, 2012, this is when I have been told that there is anticipated or planned to be some kind of a false flag threat. And I remember talking with our insider source, the Camelot insider source, Henry Deacon, about this. Henry Deacon was very knowledgeable. And I asked him, I remember a couple of years ago, whether such a thing was a possibility. He said, absolutely, this is a possibility. He said, you wouldn't believe how many craft that look like alien craft the insider military government have at their disposal. They could fill the skies, he said. I remember being quite surprised by his reaction. Since I was told about the likelihood of such a false flag event, and I was first told about this myself about a couple of months ago, I started to think about how this would happen. And, you know, there are all these sort of science fiction dramas like the TV series V and Independence Day, where you have these giant ships over every major city in the planet. And, you know, and then you think, well, what kind of resources would you need to pull that kind of thing off? But you wouldn't need much. You really wouldn't need much to set up a false flag. And what I've suggested a couple of times is with existing craft like the TR-3B, supposed to exist. It's a big triangular thing. It's about 600 feet across, 600 feet to a side. It's a big thing, half the size of an aircraft carrier. It's a giant. It's like a giant platform. These things are operational. And if you had a couple of those sitting, imagine they suddenly appeared, they swooped down from a high altitude, and then they sat there over Manhattan for half an hour, just sitting there, just like Independence Day. You wouldn't have to have them in Rio and London and Cape Town and Sydney and Beijing. Just Manhattan would do it, you know, just that. You'd have all the television cameras there. That's the way that they get to all those other cities, through television. And they sit there for half an hour, and then you imagine that one of those craft then demolishes the Statue of Liberty and kills a couple of hundred tourists. A symbolic destruction of a national monument, something that no one would dare think of, just like the destruction of the Twin Towers. And then imagine that you've got a squadron of F-22s, remotely controlled, of course, which they can do this very easily, remotely piloted F-22s go up against this thing just like in the movie Independence Day. They get shot out of the sky just like toys, and then these two giant craft just accelerate up into the sky at Mach 15, and all of this is on television. They could do that tomorrow morning. It wouldn't not even to, cost them very much. They could
not
do
to mention
that.
They could do that with current black op holographic technology.
Yeah, but you wouldn't even need holograms. You've got those craft. They could, you know, I mean, you wouldn't need holograms that could go wrong. You wouldn't even have to doctor the television footage. They could actually do this tomorrow morning. It would be simple. And it's not this kind of huge operation that they need to mount globally. You wouldn't have to have a whole global holographic display to do all of this stuff. You could do it now with the craft that they've got, just two of them. You know, they've got more than two. They've got dozens of these things.
Right.
And that's all it would take. And if you just kind of play that thought experiment out, you can imagine how easy it would be to whip the world into a frenzy, because we've already had Independence Day. We've already had the film Series V. We don't even need to know who's inside these craft. It would be so easy to hysterically claim that we're being attacked from outer space and this is real, and, you know, and these ETs aren't to be trusted, and we don't know what they're going to do next, and we've got to get our Star Wars. Right. I mean, it's so
the TV easy. Show event.
I haven't been watching it recently. I don't even know what's happened. Maybe you can clue me in on that. I started watching it and then turned it off because I thought it was so bad. But I know that, of course, it's part of the preparation.
It's bad for, on purpose, I think. They do just to like, melt my brain or something.
Just like Roland Emmerich's 2012 movie was bad. You know.
Yeah, it was horrible.
It still contains pointers. It still contains pointers.
Yeah, so, V was good.
That's my complex answer to Harley's question about what could such a false flag event be. And the reason why I lay that out in such detail is because I really want people to know how simple this would be. It would be so easy for them to do this. Mm. It would be so simple. And this might be one of the most dangerous things that we've got to face. It might be one of the most dangerous things that we've got to face, because if they do this kind of thing, then there's going to be an enormous engineered hysteria all over the world. And this is the danger, because another thing that I've been told is likely to happen is that there will be a push to criminalize or demonize the alternative media. I was told this before the Julian Assange thing came out with the WikiLeaks. I was told this before anyone knew what his name was. I was warned about this myself. I was told that this is what the FEMA camps are for. I had somebody telling me, he said, therefore, people like you, and you're near the top of the list. That's what he said. You know, it's a kind of interesting compliment. And if you imagine a sort of false flag event like I've just sketched out, and if you imagine people like myself and you and many of the people who's got a voice on blogs and radio programs all over the world suddenly saying, no, 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 they're not bad guys, they're good guys. This is a government trick. Can you imagine how quickly we'd be silenced? Can you imagine what they might want to do to take us away so that we couldn't say this kind of stuff because we would be in league with these bad ETs in some way? You know, it would be so easy to do that kind of stuff. And this is the danger. This might be, and I'm not trying to be negative or scaremongery, but it's just like as a heads up, this might be the thing that we need to really watch for over the next year or two, that this might be the challenge that we're going to have, is how to convince people that this is a trick if it happens. Because that might be one of the tipping points.
Well, Tom, I guess our names are on a list. I have another question.
We're in Canada, though. No, nobody cares that much up here.
That's true. They leave us Canadians alone. And we're out playing with the igloos.
You know, it's funny. So, Bill, I've been in this field now for about close to 30 years, right? And I'm a kind of an old school guy. And back in the day, back in the 80s and 90s, there were a lot of individuals down in the U.S. that were always claiming they were being followed by government and they were, you know, broken into their houses and so on and so forth, and implants disappearing and, you know, crash retrieval disappearing and all kinds of stuff. I always used to ask them, how come none of this stuff happens here? We never had nobody chase us down or threaten us in any big way. Maybe Canadians don't care.
I did have a general call my home when I was looking into Ed Dames. General Stumblebine called my home and said,
"Stumblebine is an American."
Bothering my boy.
That's interesting. Okay.
Do you have a question for Bill, Tom, or is that just a statement?
Yeah. I have one from Heretic, actually. Yep. Is there UFO? Oh, no. Is there any new info on. How am I going to repeat his name now? Gianluigi Zangari's view on the Gulf Loop current from the InSight and if it has indeed affected the Gulf Stream.
Yes. What he's talking about there is, and I'm not very good at pronouncing his name either, he's an Italian scientist who did some research, got very anxious that the loop current in the Gulf, which feeds the Gulf Stream, had somehow stalled. And the person who picked up that information was Dr. Bill Deagle, who's a very smart cookie and knows a lot about oceanography, as he knows a lot about a whole bunch of other things. And he publicized that. And then since then, I think it was the Earl of Stirling on an interview which he published, let me think, that was it with Alex Jones? I can't remember. But it was the Earl of Stirling, definitely, a week or two ago, said, okay, Gulf Stream's failed. If you want any proof, you don't need to look at the oceanographic data. Just go and look and see what's happening to Britain at the moment. It's under several feet of snow, and this is highly unseasonal, not in November. That never happens. And this is true. There's something very weird happening there. Okay. My personal take on this is that there are variations in the loop current, there are variations in the Gulf Stream, and that putting my scientific hat on, I'm not a formal qualified scientist, but I think like a scientist, there's not enough data yet to know that something has gone irreparably wrong. This might be just one of the oscillations in the functioning of the Gulf Stream and the oscillations in the functioning of the loop current. For sure, I understand the mechanics that the huge oil disaster in the Gulf of Mexico will have impacted on the loop current. You don't need to be Einstein to figure that out. But there are times in the past when it stopped and restarted, when there was no oil disaster in the Gulf of Mexico to do that. These things happen. There's a kind of natural trend of what the mathematicians call chaos in all of these things. And to explain what chaos is, it's like if you look at a waterfall in a river or smoke coming out of a chimney or something, it's always changing and it's never the same. And it goes this way and it goes that way. And there are all these minor differences, but the overall pattern remains the same. And I think it's too early to say that we've got a major disaster on our hands because the Gulf Stream has shut down and the Atlantic Conveyor has shut down. I think it's too early.
Right.
And ultimately, it's just a gut reaction. And I sort of tend to follow my instincts on some things. There's things I wake up in the morning and I look at them and they grab me. And then I know, or I feel that I know, that these are important things that I've got to pay attention to because they're going somewhere and that something's telling me something. And many of your listeners will know exactly what I mean by that. You may have that same experience. With this thing about the loop current in the Gulf Stream, it's not grabbing me. And so it's a subjective answer right. In the end. It's just not grabbing me. I think that this isn't a disaster. I think it's an unusual perturbation. Okay,
well, let's try another question from Fifi. Can you share a bit about the much darker secret that your insider talked about? Now, that's all I have, so no details.
Yep. Okay. I can't share a lot at the moment, but I'm willing to do a little bit of seed sowing here. I'm not being deliberately enigmatic. And I can say something about this. I've been contacted by somebody who is very well connected on the inside, who revealed a large amount of information to me And this contact began in August. And this has occupied a great deal of my time and energy since then. And a number of people have become a little bit close to this story because there are all kinds of interesting interesting dramas that occurred which involved some of the individuals who are actually listening here. This all sounds a bit enigmatic. This whole story will be told in the end because it's quite an extraordinary human story. I mean, it's just interesting, besides some parts of it being important. Now, those of you who know me quite well or have been following my work over the last few years know that I'm quite cautious and I'm quite scientific in my view. And this means that I'm not actually going to jump to publishing something just because somebody has sent me a story in an email or phoned me up saying, look, you know, I got this stuff and you've got to get it out there right now and never mind who I am. I tend to check things out quite carefully. I've learned a lot over the last 4 or 5 years. I've developed my own criteria for what I should publish immediately and what I should sit on. And I'm sitting on this because I want to check it out. There's information which I don't understand yet. There's information which I haven't yet had the opportunity to clarify and ask questions about. And so this is the context for all of this. Potentially there's something of great importance, but I don't know my facts well enough yet to be able to release it. Okay, and that's why I haven't done anything.
Are there? I'm going to add to this. Are there multiple sources for this information, or is that your problem? You're having one source, and you need to connect more dots.
One source is the problem with all intelligence information. And I mean, I'm not comparing myself to intelligence agencies, but there's a process involved here. If somebody comes to you with a story, you know, then if you can corroborate it and check it out and then get more data and then get proof and then get documents and then get somebody saying something on record because you've got them in the same room, you know, then you've really got something to act on. But if all you've got is something, it's just one person who's saying something and you haven't actually met them and they're just sending you information, then you need to be very, 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 very careful indeed. Right. And I am being very, very careful. Having said that, a lot of it fits. A lot of it is shocking. A lot of it is fascinating. A lot of it answers questions that I've had for a very long time. And some of this is starting to play out during the time that I've been in contact with this person. I mentioned that just a few minutes ago. He said to me back in September, he said, the first thing that they're going to try and do is to criminalize and demonize the alternative media. That was before the WikiLeaks thing broke, you know. Mm-hmm. And the last conversation I had with this guy, he said, look at what's happening. He said, I told you so. Now, that doesn't mean that Julian Assange is a plant. I don't believe he is at all. I think he's just like many of us. He's just doing what he can do to get the truth out, doing it in his own way, in his own style, and so on and so forth. But the point is that they're jumping on this opportunity. And this is the great danger we've got. There's a huge danger here that this has handed them an opportunity to start policing the internet, just like they're policing the airports, and they may police anything else that they want to police, if they start thinking that there are terrorists out there among us who are trying to damage public interests, national security, attacks against, you know, MasterCard and Visa and PayPal and Amazon and people like that. If all of this sort of, I mean, even now, I've heard people out there who aren't very well informed who thinks that it's WikiLeaks who's doing the hacking. I mean, you know, and all of this, just like after 9/11, people thought it was Saddam Hussein who'd attacked New York. These misperceptions are being allowed to stick in order to get the public behind the idea that just as we've got to defend ourselves against the nasty terrorists, now we've got to get ourselves defended against the nasty hackers and against the nasty leakers. You know, they're all being branded in together. Right. So I just mention that as one little tiny thing, because this is one thing that he said this was going to happen, and look at what's happened. He also told me about the plans for the false flag ET threat setup. He didn't tell me anything about how it would happen. He didn't know. He didn't know how this would do. So this theatrics I talked about the TR-3Bs hanging over Manhattan, that's just my own idea, just to show what could happen. He said this is real. He was emphatic that this was on the cards.
Okay.
The last thing that he said would happen, he said, well, no, actually, not the last thing. He said that there was going to be the probability of some extreme solar activity that, as best he knew, was being forecast for something like 2013. And this is all in the public domain.
Right.
And he said this is something that none of the controllers on planet Earth are going to be able to do anything about, because this is a huge natural phenomenon happening out there that can't be prevented or can't be stopped. But they're going to take advantage of it when it happens, just like they took advantage of the WikiLeaks thing. If anything happens out there in the environment in which they're operating, they seize on this to take advantage of it in order to further whatever agenda they had. So that's something that he drew my attention to. The last thing is the plans to reduce the world population. And he said that this will be done through the control and the distribution of food. He said that there will not be a nuclear war. He said that this is off the table. This will not happen. And there are interesting reasons for that. But he said that the reduction of the world's population was going to happen through the control and distribution of food. And this had been set up for many years beforehand by the introduction of genetically modified crops. And they, when they've got all the pieces in place, then metaphorically they turn off the switch, and that turns off the food supply. I mean, all of these things are part of this mix, but by controlling the weather, by controlling the law, by controlling distribution, by controlling other factors, they can actually move these huge infrastructure vectors around in order basically to control who lives and who dies. And he was absolutely adamant that this was planned, had been planned for a very long time. He believed it was almost unstoppable. I don't necessarily believe that myself at all, but he, like many people who have been on the inside, they spend so much time in the physical company of people who are sure of their ground and sure of their plans. And as George Green famously told us a couple of years ago, he said, they think they've already won. I ran this past my contact, and he said, yeah. He said, that's absolutely right. They think that they've won. And it is part of their protocol or the rules of engagement or cultural requirements, whatever words you want to put on this, to leave the signs of what they're doing out in the open for those who are smart enough to pick them up and see. They have to do that. He's told me this a dozen times now. He says, they have to do it. They have to do it. They're required to do it somehow. To everything is in plain sight. But you've got to be smart, and you've got to be aware, and you've got to be well-informed in order to put all the pieces together. And from their point of view, that's our problem, not theirs. And so this is something that he assured me was planned. When I asked him for a timetable, again, he said these things are
event-driven.
Sequence-driven. They're sequence-driven. They're event-driven. They're not calendar-driven.
Right.
He did say to me that these things that we'll know pretty much one way or the other, whether we've lost this giant Super Bowl game or not, in the next 5 or 6 years, and the implementation of this plan, they figure, should be complete within the next decade or so. 2012, he said, it's a whole distraction. He said it's theatrics. He told me that mind control on a kind of population controlling basis was more advanced than we would ever want to believe. And he said that certain individuals were just basically controlled like puppets. Their technology for doing this, and I don't know exactly what the technology is. This is one of the details which I need to understand better. But the technology is very, very advanced for controlling the thinking of large groups of people as well as directing the thinking of individuals. And all of this is part of a big push. And what they're doing, the reason why they're doing this is because they are trying to optimize the human race. They want to optimize the human race. Just like the farmer wants to optimize their breed of cattle, or the forest keeper wants to optimize the population of the deer by allowing the weak or the elderly or the infirm deer to die out, and maybe shooting certain deer but not others in order to control the herd, which makes it stronger and more viable. What this man has told me is that these people who are controlling the rollout of all of this absolutely believe that they are doing the responsible and right thing. They're not sort of a caricature of some kind of crazy, evil Dr. Strangelove character twirling their moustache and planning the next dastardly deed. They're not like that. They believe that they're doing the best for the human race. And the reason why they believe they're doing the best for the human race is because they don't, their ethics is a different kind of ethics. They're not concerned about individual people. Just like the farmer isn't concerned about individual cattle, and the forest keeper isn't concerned about the individual deer. They're concerned about the herd. They're concerned about the genetic line that they've got. And these people are trying to optimize the DNA of the human race. And this is why they don't want to have a nuclear war. Because a nuclear war, if you drop a few nuclear bombs all over the place, they wipe people out indiscriminately. They wipe out the good stock and the bad stock. It's like trying to cull the deer in the forest by dropping a cluster bomb in the middle of the forest. You don't actually get rid of the deer that you want to get rid of. It's not selective. The reason why they want to reduce the human population through the distribution and supply of food is because the problems that will arise will result in the survival of the smartest, the healthiest, those who've anticipated the problem, those who are best able to survive in groups, those who are best able to improvise, those who are good at troubleshooting problematic situations, and everybody else isn't going to go through that filter. And so what they want as a result of this is to end up with a human genome that's leaner and meaner and better able to survive, but at the same time can be more easily controlled. That's what they want. I've been specifically told this. And I find that I can believe it, I'm afraid.
Yeah.
I'm not saying I believe it's going to happen, but it makes a dreadful sense. It makes everything fit.
It sounds like a bit like the upgrade to Auschwitz.
Yeah.
Hey, I do have a question from Richard, who is the administrator of Project Avalon and helps with the website, the forum. And he says, and I guess we're going to drill down into the solar question. He says, has there been any insider buzz about the unusually active solar activity in the coming years that may cause Earth some serious problems?
All that I know is that my contact told me that there were, no, let me start that sentence again, that some kind of extreme solar activity was being prepared for as an external event that could only be prepared for and not stopped. His personal buzz was that this was expected in something like 2013, but he didn't really know. And there's something I need to say here, is that my contact isn't a scientist. He isn't an academic, and he isn't a historian.
Is he military?
His role is quasi-military. He's not actually in the services. You could describe his role as like being logistics, security, and quasi-military. So, but he's not a scientist. So there are 101 questions which I wanted to ask him, which he just didn't know the answers to because I was asking him data-based and scientific-based questions, and he did not have those answers. On the inside, people are informed on the need to know as well, as we understand, and there are lots of things which he didn't need to know. He just needed to know just enough for him to do his job. And so there's much, much more to this story which I just outlined. There's a lot more to that story, which I'm not in a position to talk about yet, simply because I don't understand it well enough. But in terms of practical, what can I call it? Practical situational things to watch for, be on guard against, and depending on one's philosophy, to work in whatever way we can do to influence, to change, then my personal belief right now is that what I was sketching out, that's pretty real. I believe that's pretty real in terms of threats. I don't think that this is going to transpire. I really don't. But what I do know is between now and, let's say, I don't know, in the next handful of years, I think you and me and everyone listening to this, we've got to do a lot of stuff in order to wake people up enough so that these things cannot stick. And there's some good news among all this. He told me, for instance, that the whole swine flu, bird flu vaccination thing, that those plans had been shelved because people had woken up so quickly and there was so much activism and protest, and which even flowed into the mainstream media, and ordinary people who'd never protested against anything in all their lives were starting to, you know, read the leaflets and talk to their neighbors about this stuff. Everything was happening last year. He said that, okay, they've gone on to a different tack now. You see, so our response can make a difference. And he cited that as an example of something which had been shelved because the response was more vocal and more active and more aware than anyone had anticipated. And so that's right. Good model for us. It's a good model because it worked.
Yeah.
That's good. Morning Sun has a question, Bill. He's asking, what about the ground crews? Should we still be organizing survival groups?
That's a great question. I think there's a real role for the ground crew movement. I really do think that. I don't know how they should be organized. I don't know how they should be, you know, what they should call themselves. But the idea of community groups who can work together to support each other if things get a little bit tough, it's a pretty smart idea. And what has happened, of course, it's linked with what I was talking about an hour ago when I said, well, you know what, we were all really worried back in 2008 that there was going to be a real problem. We needed to get ourselves organized quick. And then nothing really happened. There was a whole scare about the swine flu. The ground crews swung into action and started leafleting and informing people and blogging and telling the public. And that really worked. The danger is a kind of complacency that people think, well, you know, I guess everything's okay now. And that, again, is related to the question we were talking about an hour ago about, you know, you're saying, well, is it doom and gloom, or have David Wilcock and Ben Fulford got it right? I think that there's still a role for the ground crew. I think that there's still a role for people to be forming community groups. I'm not talking about militia at all. I'm not talking about anything violent. I'm just talking about groups where if tricky things started to happen, you'd know who you could communicate with, you'd know who could do what, you'd know who had which resources, and you'd know who you could count on. And one of the problems, and when I was really beating the ground crew drum about a year ago, I used to say, the problem with the virtual world that we've got, which we're experiencing right now, of course, we're connected as a community group that's extended over thousands of miles all the way across the world. If the internet goes down, or if there are real problems in your town, that's not a lot of help knowing that you guys are there rooting for me in Canada. You know, it doesn't help me at all if I'm here in Europe. And we're living in an age where in Victorian days, we were much better off than we are now, because those days people knew the people in their street, they knew the people in their village, they knew the people in their town. Most people here living in an apartment block don't even know who lives behind the door, on the other side of the staircase, on the other side of the elevator from them. We don't know who our neighbors are. And these are kind of human basics that we need to remind ourselves of, because we don't know when we might need to depend on knowing who lives in our street and who is in our apartment block. This illusion of a community, this virtual community that we've got, which we're enjoying right now, it might be an illusion, because I don't think they can turn off the internet with a kill switch, like some people have said, you know. But if there's solar activity that hits us in 2013, that could be just a wonderful opportunity for the controllers to capitalize on the fact that all of this grid goes down, and then they start rolling out their scenario, which I was describing 10 minutes ago, about the control and distribution of food. And then it doesn't even matter whether I've got mates in Canada or Australia, because I'm here trying to solve my problems in Central Europe, and, you know, it doesn't matter if I've got a friend on the other side of the world. I can't talk to them, I can't reach them, I probably can't travel, and I've got to depend on my neighbor, and I don't even know what their name is. And so that's the kind of function of the ground crew, is to form local support groups, and I really do think there's a role for them.
Harit is asking a question. What are your opinions on chemtrails?
I don't really know what chemtrails are. And I'm saying that because Kerry and I, in all the work that we've done in the last 4 years, we've never had anyone come to us saying, hey, I'll give you the lowdown on chemtrails. It's just something that people haven't talked to us about. Okay. We did have somebody tell us last year in the middle of the swine flu thing, where it felt very credible, that there was a component in the chemtrails that was designed to react with the component of some of the vaccinations, like a binary weapon, that on their own they were harmless. Put together, they were possibly very dangerous. We got some evidence for that with the reports that we had in the Ukraine of low-level spraying followed by an extremely virulent, nasty, kind of super swine flu type bug that went straight to people's lungs. And everyone got very agitated about that, and then all that kind of seemed to go away. I think that there's a lot of evidence which is well testified, that there's another component of chemtrails which has got to do with optimizing the performance of HARP in ways which I'm not scientifically qualified enough to be able to lay out in detail. All of that is a complicated way of saying I don't really know, and I wish I knew more.
That's good answers. I have a question from Fred, also an administrator at Project Avalon. He said, I am curious if you've heard of what makes these elite think they will escape the wrath of their creation and still control it.
That's a great kind of philosophical
Fred type question.
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, it's almost not a question. It's like saying, well, you know what? I don't know. Maybe they won't escape this, you know. Maybe, I mean, who knows how all this is going to play out? Who knows how all this is going to play out? There's plenty of time yet. I mean, it's a paradox. I'm kind of urging people on because I'm saying, okay, look, you know, we don't have the time to be complacent, and we may only have a handful of years here during which this tipping point is going to tip, you know, one way or the other, and which is another way of saying to us really to find out which timeline we're solidly on here. And on the other hand, you know, there's plenty of time here for these, for the controllers to sort of get their comeuppance, as it were. And one way of my enlarging on that, I guess, is to say that I actually believe what my insider contact told me, that these guys do not, you know, that they really believe that they're doing the responsible thing. They really take what they consider to be the guardianship of the human race seriously and personally. They think of it as their job. They're trying to execute it to the best of their capacity. My honest personal belief is that if I ever had the opportunity to meet one of these men in conversation, I do not think I would be meeting somebody who I would recognize as being an evil man. I don't believe that. I think I could have a very intelligent conversation with that man, and I think I would make my best possible presentation to them that they were misguided, that they were basing their conclusions on inappropriate or incomplete premises. But right. I don't believe that we're talking about a great evil. And I think characterizing it in that black and white way is a sort of dialectic device that we've almost been trained to see things in. I think it's a little bit more subtle than that. And so, once again, this question has gone around in a big loop, you know. And what I would like to think, and here, let me revert back to my analogy that I mentioned a while ago, that I see all this as being a giant game, a non-trivial game, but it's like a huge game. What happens at the end of a game is that everyone, you know, sits back and takes stock, and they think, well, you know, I could have played that better, or I wish I'd passed the ball differently, or it's a shame that I didn't see that one coming, or you know what, I did a good job in, you know, when this thing happened, or whatever. And they analyze the game and they talk about it. And I suppose my answer to what Fred has said is that at the end of this game, I would like to think that some of the main players in this game would look back on the game and think, you know what, maybe I could have done that better. Maybe I made some bad choices. Maybe I wished I'd checked my assumptions better. Maybe right. I could have done this whole thing in a different way. And so from a kind of spiritual perspective, that's the learning that I think is available from this game. And all of us will be learning things from this game. And of course, this is one of the reasons why we're here. There's an esoteric aspect to this as well. We're all playing this as hard and as well as we possibly can do, and sometimes we make bad calls. And that applies to us, and it applies to them. We're all capable of making bad calls. There are no immortal godlike beings here at this human level who are infallible. We're all fallible, and that includes them. And part of the learning that they may have the opportunity of taking out of all this is their own fallibility and their own mistakes.
Okay. I have two quick questions, from one from Hurret, and the other one from Cosmic Dagon. First one is, Bill, what are your thoughts on NASA's arsenic-based life form? And the second one is, Bill, any more info on the individual who contacted you with regard to Anthony Sanchez, Colonel X?
Oh, right. Ha. First of all, arsenic-based life forms. I would say that we're being very gently prepared in a very low-key way for the possibility that there are other things out there. And we get this in a kind of steady stream of little articles and announcements from the Pope's astronomer. And, you know, there's another big Earth-like planet out there. And you know what? There could be water on Titan or where, you know. And this is just another one of those. I don't think it's significant. I think it adds to them trying to steer the collective cultural awareness into a preparation for the fact that we're not alone, you know, and that life out there could look like anything, something like that.
Right.
Regarding Anthony Sanchez. Colonel X. Wow. Yeah. So, I mean, see, this is worth a radio show in itself. I haven't had the opportunity of talking with Anthony Sanchez, and we had an interview scheduled, an audio interview scheduled, which he cancelled because of a personal emergency, and I think the personal emergencies that he's coping with are very real at the moment. And I don't know him personally, never spoken to him, but bless him, I think he's been suffering personally for what he's, you know, which may well be connected with the information that he's trying to release. I read his book, UFO Highway, and the only thing which I want to say about that is that I have edited a lot of transcripts of interviews, Camelot interviews and Avalon interviews. I've transcribed some of them myself. I've edited transcripts, and it's like, trust me, I know what an interview transcript sounds like when it's a real interview. What was written in that book was not the transcript of an interview that actually happened. I'm telling you that as a fact. That was not the transcript of an actual interview. People don't talk like that. Now, this is a problem because...
Now, what does that mean? Yeah.
Well, it's a problem because I believe that this encounter and some kind of a conversation absolutely happened. I absolutely believe that. I would like to think that the explanation for this anomaly is that Anthony Sanchez made an error of judgment in heavily editing the interview himself to make it more readable. The context of a book.
An urgent
text. A little text message to make sure that she's around, because she said that she would very much like to be part of this. Okay. She agrees with me about this because she's very familiar with what an interview should read like. And this does not read like a conversation. It absolutely doesn't. It's been heavily edited. And one of the reasons for that might simply be that Anthony Sanchez thought that it should be improved for reading. The problem is that it casts doubt in the minds of the reader, thinking, wait a minute, you know, there's something about this and it doesn't quite sound right. The reason why it doesn't sound right is because people don't talk like that in interviews. If you transcribe this interview, you will get short sentences. The use of short words. You get hesitations. You get repetitions. You'll get broken sentences. You get people forgetting what they're saying and starting something else. All of this kind of thing will happen. The other problem which Kerry agrees with me about, is that there's some of that information that just doesn't stack up. It just doesn't stack up fully. And right. This is kind of beyond the scope of this current conversation to go into that. And I feel a little uncomfortable talking about it because I haven't had the opportunity to talk with Anthony about this himself. And, of course, there are many questions which I'd like to put to him. And there may be good answers to them. And at the moment, we're just kind of – we're sort of talking about the guy behind his back, which is a little unkind.
Yeah, we'll leave it at that. I have a question. What do you see as the direction of Project Avalon now and your project and what you're doing and Project Camelot?
That's a great question. And it'd be very interesting, actually, to have Kerry on the show as well so we can answer this together. And yeah, it sounds like she's there. Is she there?
Hi there, yes.
Hey,
welcome,
you're real.
Kerry Cassidy to Spectrum Radio Network. And we're having a conference with Bill Ryan. And I'm here, Scott Jordan, my co-host, Tom Theofanis. I'm glad you could join us.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
And I just asked Bill a question. He'll relate it to you.
Oh, why don't you ask the question again, actually, so that Kerry gets the whole thing from the horse's mouth.
Okay.
And then we can both answer this together, and it's a lot of fun. Because he came in just at the exact perfect entrance.
We even laid it all out for you. And it wasn't planned. I had a question about the direction now of Project Avalon, which is Bill's project, and Project Camelot, which is a shared project between the two of you. What do you see coming up for the next year or so?
Let me have a shot at this first of all, and I won't talk for as long as I've been talking for the
Good luck with that.
There's a significant overlap between Kerry's view and my view of the questions that we've got to ask, the answers to those questions, and we've got a huge shared database of experience. And a lot of people out there, including ourselves, are delighted to know that we're working very well behind the scenes on a number of projects. We talk to each other very regularly, and we're in very strong agreement about I think almost everything that we've been talking about on this show. And I'm going to be delighted to be part of a much wider ranging conversation that's going to include all of this and much more with David Wilcock and Richard Hoagland, and that means that no one will ever get any of us to shut up when we all get talking together about all of this. And this is a project which I'm delighted to be part of. At the moment, it's very appropriate that I'm kind of following my interests and that Kerry's kind of following hers. But what we've been discovering is that there's a lot of overlap. There's a lot of common ground. There's lots of room for us to continue to work closely together. And yet there's a justification for us continuing to have an independent sort of platform for me to say, well, you know, this is what I'm interested in, and this is what I think, and this is what I'm following up, and this is what I'm researching. In the meantime, Kerry's doing her counterpart to that. But we do have some common projects which we're going to really enjoy rolling out next year if all goes well. Kerry, what do you say to all this?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that it's speaking of this weekend on Sunday with David Wilcock and Richard Hoagland, I mean, all these people, ourselves included, can actually talk up a storm. So I have no idea. Orchestrating that sort of coming together of the minds is going to be very fascinating also. And a challenge, and should be a lot of fun, especially between David and Richard, because the two of them are, as most people will know, both flamboyant equally in their own right, I would say. Of course, they're wonderful minds. And then, of course, there's Bill and I, which we're a little bit, we're not quite as outspoken, I don't think, although I think I'm a little more towards that end of the spectrum. But anyway, maybe in a different way. But yes, in answer to your question, I think that we are working behind the scenes on some projects. And I think that as we go forward, there's obviously some synchronicities that are going on that cause us to want to maybe publish or co-publish together. But I think at the same time, we also still have, as we discovered over the, well, it's nearly 5 years that we've been in operation, that we both have very different personalities and we have some very divergent interests on top of everything. So I wouldn't want to abandon those. And we're having a lot of fun over at the Camelot Forum. And, you know, we're
working also, you have a radio show.
That's right. And my radio show on American Freedom Radio on Wednesdays from 7 to 9 p.m. Pacific time. I'll take this opportunity to say. And then on ArcuSug, 11 a.m. Pacific time, and that's like 7 p.m. in England and 8 p.m. in Europe. So it's more of a European style radio show, and it has no commercials. And that's on Fridays, and I have Bill Brown on Friday, and I have Richard Dolan, as a matter of fact, on Wednesday, which is tomorrow. So that should be very exciting. But at any rate, yes, it's lovely to do things together. And I think that we're a great complementary team, as it were. So I think that we will continue to do things together in the future, actually.
And there could be some fun rollouts of various projects next calendar year, 2011, which we can't say a lot about at the moment because we've been working on them for the last few months. And with a little bit of luck, there could be a lot of entertainment for people in store. And that's something that we're looking forward to, but we can't say a lot about it at the moment.
Okay. Carrie, do you have any news from any insiders that you've been speaking to?
Let's see, news. It'd have to be a little more specific than that. I don't get like specific news other than what I put on my blog. My blog, for those who don't know, is extremely active. And so I post there daily at this point and sometimes multiple times during the day. I'm also writing articles as I go. And what will happen there is that I will post tips that I'm getting from various insiders as we go along. And that depends on whether or not there's an incident in particular to discuss. And so, you know, with the missile that was off the coast of California, I was getting multiple reports from various different insiders. That was all playing out very interestingly. I think ultimately, I had Sean David Morton on my radio show on American Freedom Radio, and that show is archived for those of you that are interested. And his insider information seemed to maybe trump some of the information we were getting from other sources. But it's unclear, and that information was not completely clear as it came through. So I don't consider that story, for example, to be a closed one. I think that that's a still open story, and I think we're still it's still worth pursuing for those researchers out there that want to compare notes. But at any rate, if you do want to compare notes, then I suggest you pay a visit to my blog, see what I was writing back then, see what my insiders were saying, and compare that to my radio show. And then also the same thing goes for the BP oil spill. And again, we're getting various information. And I have to say the information about the Gulf of Aden as well. So there's a lot of mixed stuff coming in, and it just depends on what kind of subject you want to talk about.
Yeah, sure. What I would just like to get a question, is there any questions for Bill and Carrie? I have one here from Petroleum. And that's the opinion on the Sweden change of law to have more control over the net and co-opt the U.S. FBI. Thanks. to the lonely suicide bomber in Stockholm. Any thoughts on that?
My take is that that's not connected.
Okay.
I mean, of course, when Sweden starts coming up in the news in lots of different ways, you start thinking, wait a minute, what's happening here? But it's a little hard to manufacture a connection there. That's my take on that.
Yeah.
Well, actually, I don't know. I have to delve into that more deeply. But the whole Julian Assange charges, the situation with WikiLeaks and the situation with Freedom on the Net is obviously linked. But what is being orchestrated, for example, and what Norway, I have to say Norway and Sweden, very, very strong strongholds of the Illuminati and above, let's say, as well as certain ETs that I'm aware of, that, you know, I have to say that there's something going on there that's quite dark in my view.
Okay.
And so it's not surprising that something like that would come out of Sweden at this time. I think the crackdowns going on in the northern part of the hemisphere, if you will, are a symptom of some very interesting dynamics going on.
Okay.
Okay. Well, I guess we have one more question from
Undead Pixel.
For Kerry, what is your opinion on David Wilcox, China's October surprise?
You mean the gifts that were set at the sort of doorstep of all the countries? Well, I mean, I did make a blog post very specifically about China, and for those that are listening here, I will say that was addressed to David, but and to a few other people. But I what I did say in that, for those of you who, if you go to my website, projectcamelotproductions.com, you will see that I've created a new page called Articles. And that way you don't have to search through my whole blog in order to get some of my more succinct articles that I'm starting to write. And one of those was just a very short article about China and a cautionary note telling people that I don't see China as the next new world savior, so to speak, by any stretch of anyone's imagination. What Fulford, in essence, and Wilcock is saying it, but basically his information comes from Fulford and that kind of camp, if you will. And I'm saying that I don't, you know, I Ben Fulford is just the most delightful guy, and it was absolutely thrilling to go in person and meet him, and that was one of the rare Camelot moments in which we, again, did what we did with Burisca. We basically kind of took the bull by the horns and just went for it and had no idea we'd actually make it there and had no idea how we'd pay for it and so on and so forth. But it all worked out. And for those of you who haven't seen our interview with Benjamin Fulford, then I highly recommend it because I think we got more information out of him than anyone has even since. But I have to say also that he has been manipulated heavily. And I do think that he, you know, he's working for the good. So that's a very bottom line. And he's a very good-hearted guy. And he wants the best for the world. But I don't think his handlers, so to speak, do necessarily.
I would completely concur with that, let me say. I think Kerry stated exactly correctly.
What's your thoughts, Bill, on the surprise packages?
I agree with Kerry, actually, on pretty much everything that he said. I think that let me think. I'm not sure if I could improve on what Kerry has said, actually. It might be better to take the next question to squeeze a few questions on, because I do actually agree with everything that Kerry said, and I think that you said it in a way that I couldn't improve on, certainly regarding David. Certainly regarding Fulford, and the way that I believe he is being influenced or manipulated in some ways. I certainly do not believe everything that I believe on his blog, and I don't believe it quite as much as I think David Wilcock does, and it could well be that this is a very interesting conversation that we'll get into on Sunday.
Okay. I have a question from Luke, and it's a quick question, and actually, no, it's from Sizemorg. And it is, hold on a second. Are we following a script set down by the powers that be?
Well, yes, that question can mean many different things, can't it?
It's a very broad question, yeah.
Yeah. I think I know what he means. It's like the kind of, you know, an example of that would be the whole problem-reaction-solution script, the way that the world fell into a script after 9/11, and they all kind of went along on predetermined lines by reacting in certain ways, and then that allowed everyone to be steered, and so on and so forth. I think that there are continuing strong attempts to do that with quite some success. But more and more, I believe that this is not working. And this dovetails back to some of the things I was saying in the last hour to an hour and a half. For example, about the whole swine flu vaccinations thing. There's meant to be a script there, but we didn't follow that script.
Right.
And they had to break away from that script, according to what I've been told. That's not going to work anymore. People are just going to refuse these things. They're going to have to think of something else. And so there's more changes of plans, ducking and weaving, improvisation going on. And the signs of this, and for Kerry's benefit, who probably wasn't able to hear the earlier part of the show, I was referring, Kerry, to how you and I back in 2008 were really very anxious that something quite serious might be happening towards the back end of that year. And but nothing did happen. And there are many indications that what was planned, these things haven't rolled out, the timelines have changed, or the plans have changed, depending on what metaphor one wants to use. Or another way of putting that is that the scripts are not being followed anymore. Kerry, what do you think?
We lost Kerry. But I do have another question for the administrator of Project Avalon, Richard.
You may need to call her back, because I was talking to her just yesterday, and her Skype connection kept on breaking up in ways that were beyond her control. So just try her again.
Okay.
It's a little expect-
Don, if you could just call Kerry back, that'd be great. I have a question from Richard, and it is widely believed in the awake community that human history as our books portrayed is completely distorted. Has your insider or any of your insiders shared any information as to our real history,
history?
That's a great question. I'm going to answer it by saying yes.
That's a great answer. Yeah.
At the moment, I'm not in a position to enlarge on it because I don't understand the details well enough. But the answer to that is absolutely categorically yes. I've only just started to scrape the surface of this, of some of the information that has been explained to me over the last few months. And I'm being cautious about this, because I don't want to be presenting information that may be either incomplete, incompletely understood, or in some cases might not be totally correct. I need to be very, very sure of my ground. What I have told you so far is what I'm pretty sure of.
Okay. I have a question from... Who is this question from? It says Dale. Okay, I guess it's a question from Dale. What is your opinion concerning the peak oil? Concerning the topic of peak oil? And this is from one of the moderators at Project.
Yeah, Project, right. Dale. Yeah. Dale's a very smart cookie, and it's a very smart question. I'm not a geophysicist, and so I'm dependent upon others to supply me with information that then I look at with whatever, you know, intelligence I can apply. I became very interested during the whole Gulf oil disaster there, looking into the idea of abiotic oil, because it was being extensively discussed. There are some very plausible and intelligent reports written about that. There are descriptions of the researchers that the Russians had done into this. There were some very logical arguments that said, listen, you know, if we're pulling oil up from really deep down, like the Russians have been, as deep down as 40,000 feet, you know, those sediments weren't laid. I mean, those are too deep for those sediments to have been laid simply through layers of rotting vegetation back in the Cretaceous era or whenever it was. And I was interested and impressed by those arguments that this had to be coming up from kind of deep down within the earth itself. I was starting to find those arguments quite compelling. The insider contact who I've been in touch with for the last few months specifically and emphatically told me that peak oil was a reality. And he said that there was something like 25 or 30 years left and there was no such thing as abiotic oil as best he knew. All I can do is to report those experiences to you, the experience I had of finding the abiotic oil arguments interesting and compelling, and also reporting to you what I was told by my contact based on conversations he had heard, and also bearing in mind that he was not a scientist or a geophysicist of any kind or an oil engineer. He's just reporting conversations that he has heard on the inside. That's as best as I can do.
Yeah. Yeah, during that whole Gulf oil event, you had joined another forum that was, or you were monitoring another forum that had oil men in it, men that worked in the oil industry, and they were pointing out all kinds of stuff that you were posting on Project Avalon that was, you know, coming from the guys who had the boots on the ground sort of thing.
Yeah. Yes, that's right. That forum was called the Oil Drum. A very simple URL. It's called theoildrum.com. And there were a lot of smart people there, oil engineers, exploration geophysicists, people who worked with their hands dirty and their boots covered in oil for 30 years and whose opinions needed to be taken into account. They were being, you know, these aren't spokespeople for BP. Those were experienced, no-nonsense oil men. And some of those were clearly very intelligent, very well-informed people. And I began to pay quite a lot of attention to them because they were laughing, I mean literally laughing, at some of the things that I had told them that Lindsay Williams had said. And I intend Lindsay Williams no harm here, but it was very clear that in his reports during the summer to Jeff Rentz and Alex Jones, he had been misinformed. And whether that was an accident, whether it was a problem of his understanding, or whether he was being deliberately played, which I think is the case, these guys, these oil men on the oil drum were able to correct me. They said, you know, they knew exactly what the pressures were in the Macondo well. Everything was known about the geology. You don't get oil in granite, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And they showed me all of the documents. They showed me all of the stuff. They showed me all of the maps. And I began
to find myself
thinking. They really laid it out, you know, and they're smart people. And I began to realize that all of, you know, that the floor of the Gulf of Mexico wasn't going to collapse. There wasn't going to be a giant tsunami. There wasn't an oil volcano. There wasn't any of this stuff going on. It was just a serious engineering problem that was right on the limits of human technology. And I began to realize it was going to be solved, and it was. I do think that there are complications there. We've only got about three or four minutes of the show left, so we can't go into that either. But
my neighbor actually did knock me off the internet that time. I had to run upstairs and ask them to rehook me up. So I have a rental place upstairs. It's like a holiday rental. So these holiday people had just come and decided to unplug the internet. Anyway, I have to say I don't agree with some of what Bill's conclusions were on that. And that is because I actually was approached by someone who's very connected to the scene in BP and the scene out there. And I can't reveal too much about him other than to say I met him in person and his family was also involved. But he has a strong history of being involved in that area. It is a geologically unstable area. There is some volcanic stuff going on under there. There are some very strong issues like microbes that do eat through metal, which is legitimate. And there are other things going on, such as ET bases that are under there. There appears to be a very strong reason why they do want to clear out the population of the Louisiana Delta and all of that area, including New Orleans, and that's been part of their plan for quite some time. This was just another one of the dominoes in that rollout. So I have to say the Jesse Ventura show on BP Oil was quite good. It did outline some of the more mainstream things that are going on. It's quite diabolical.
Okay. Well, we got about 2 minutes left. So if there's any information, what I'd like to do is, Bill, if you'd like to give out any information about how people can contact you or how they can get on the Avalon forum or check out your website. And Carrie, if you do the same, that'd be great.
Bill? Yes, I will. Let me say that, of course, any time Kerry and I are together, we always run out of time. And this and many other things we're going to be able to talk about on Sunday with David Wilcock and Richard Hoagland, and no one's going to be able to get any of us to shut up, which is going to be really quite interesting. And we're certainly not going to agree on everything, that's for sure. But it'll be a very interesting exchange of information. I think that this is one way to put it. I'm hugely looking forward to that. You can contact me either bill@projectcamelot.org or bill@projectavalon.net. They all come through to the same place. Anyone wants to join the Avalon Forum, there's a if you click on the register button, if you're not a member, then there's a whole process that we go through whereby we send you an application and we then invite you if you think that you're the kind of person we'd like to invite. And I don't want to filibuster Kerry off the end of this here.
You've of course, your website Kerry, is
you want to say
projectavalon.com.
And no, it's projectavalon.net.
Net, right.
Projectavalon.net and projectcamelot.org.
Okay.
And don't say projectcamelot.net ever because that was an ex-webmaster who basically stole our URL there. So we're still trying to negotiate. Getting it back from him. But in the meanwhile, my website is, of course, projectcamelot.org. That takes you to the portal. And my personal website, projectcamelotproductions.com. And we also have projectlightwarrior.com. And we have a forum, camelotforum.com, which we're having a lot of fun over there. And we don't send applications. So we have a more laissez-faire attitude towards that, as was apparent in the early days of Bill and I on Avalon. So at any rate, thank you for having me as a guest.
It was my pleasure. I'd like to thank Bill Ryan for being here. I'd like to thank Carrie Cassidy for being here. I'd like to thank all of the moderators that helped out to make this a smooth event. I'd like to thank Don and Doug at BBS Radio for making it happen. I'd also like to mention this is a special broadcast that we're doing, and that we will be doing our regular show at 7:55 p.m. Pacific tonight, or a 10:55 Eastern tonight. So this is just a special event we're doing for the Project Abalone community and all the members. I'd like to thank you for your questions and your time and joining us today. Thank you, everyone.